The Numinous Podcast with Carmen Spaniola.
Hi there, and welcome to the Numinous Podcast, where we have interesting conversations with everyday folks about the mystery of life. I'm your host, Carmen Spaniola, joining you from the lands of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples, the Songhees, and the Esquimalt First Nations, recently known as Victoria, BC, Canada. There's a new book out that's been top of the BC bestseller list for months now. It was one of the best-selling books from BC in 2023, actually. I picked it up and found it riveting. I devoured it in two sittings and reached out to the publisher. I had to speak with the author. You should see like how many book darts and underlines I've made in this book. If you're a horse person or an environmentalist, of course you're going to love this book. But also, if you're someone keen to learn how settlers can support Indigenous science and sovereignty and land back efforts, you'll get lots out of Wayne McCrory's example. There's also kind of a low-key mystical aspect to the book, too. Through the sharing of his dreams and experiences on the land, you get the sense that there's an underlying subtext here around a scientist encountering his spiritual self and seeking to defend and protect something bigger, something ineffable, yet essential to the human spirit. The book is called The Wild Horses of the Chilcotin, Their History and Future. Its author, Wayne McCrory, won the Basil Stewart Stubbs Prize for Outstanding Scholarly Book on British Columbia. Wayne McCrory is a registered professional biologist specializing in the study of wild horses, bears, and western toads. He's a recipient of the Land Champion Award, which recognizes an individual for making exemplary contributions over time to protecting land, water, and strengthening communities. He was a driving force in the creation of the Kutzmatin Grizzly Sanctuary, as well as the Kitisew Spirit Bear Conservancy. So remember, that's the more than 100,000 hectares of protected lands where the spirit bears live. You know, those bears, those are the black bears that have a white appearance. They're bears of great mystical and ecological importance. Wayne is a leading expert on bear conservation and human-bear conflict, who worked for 30 years with many others to end BC's grizzly bear trophy hunt. Wayne has published more than 90 scientific reports on wildlife and conservation, including two technical reports on wild horses in BC and Alberta. Along with horse genetics expert Dr. Gus Cawthron, Wayne has co-authored two reports on the genetics of wild horses in the Chilcotin. His research led to the creation by the Tsleil-Waututh Nation of the first wild horse preserve in Western Canada. Wayne McCrory is a living legend and a national treasure, and I am delighted to share with you my conversation with him about the wild horses of the Chilcotin. So Wayne, what identities do you lead with?
I wear many different hats, so it just depends on my mood and the topic. I'm a professional wildlife biologist and conservation activist of long standing in BC, and love animals and love doing research. And and I live in a rural area and I work with communities and First Nations and love BC and want to help save the planet. Mm.
Well, you've contributed to that with your book, The Wild Horses of the Chilcotin, Their History and Future. I have a personal interest in this, having done my pack horse guide training, my backcountry wilderness guide training in the Chilcotin. And I have a real affinity for horses going back ancestrally, and a place that I'm connected to in the Okanagan. I've seen wild horses that I believe are in the care of the Penticton, part of the Okanagan First Nations Alliance. I believe it's the Penticton Band that sort of stewards this herd of wild horses in that area. And so I'm very interested in their protection and protection of habitat. So your book has been just an incredible resource. I would love to introduce people to this notion that wild horses are in fact native to North America, but we just happen to have this kind of 5,000 year gap. Can you take us back to explain to us how are the wild horses, in fact, native in North America?
Well, I think a lot of us who grew up in BC and were enamored with horses, or as I was as a boy, quite taken with Chilcot and cowboy stories and all those romantic things. And the sort of common precept was that the horses were recent arrivals with the settlers, and they escaped from ranches and stuff and ran wild, and are these horrible feral animals that overgraze and overpopulate the landscape and don't belong out there. And that was actually my precept when I first went to the Chilcotin to study grizzly bears for the Huntingatine First Nations back in 2021 to help protect an area called the Brittany Triangle. And having lived in the Galapagos Islands for 3 months many years ago, just after it was a national park, and witnessed firsthand the horrendous destruction of the habitat of so many species, Galapagos finches and stuff, by feral goats and feral pigs and feral cows and feral horses and feral rats. I arrived in the Chilcotin with this cowboy history that they were all, horses were bad anyhow, and the Galapagos experience. So it was like a double whammy attitude when I started seeing these beautiful wild horses way out in the Chilcotin. And I thought, what the hell are they doing here? You know, why are they here? I thought they were all eradicated. And as time went on, I started looking into them more closely. And the deeper I dug, the more I learned. And I actually found that from the First Nations, that the horses had been out there long before the white man. And that piqued my interest further. And I thought, well, if they were here before the white man, how did they ever get here? You know, how did the First Nations get them? So the more I moved back in history, the more I found that, you know, they actually evolved in North America over the last 50 million years ago. And during the glacial ages, including the last one, they survived in ice-free refugia, a big one being in the northern Yukon, believe it or not, north of the Arctic Circle, where the Yukon horse, the same species as today's horse, evolved with different predators and stuff. And very intensive archaeological and genetic research shows that those horses went extinct 5,000 years ago, but they had, prior to that, migrated across the Bering Land Bridge to Europe and Asia, where they were domesticated. And so if you look at it from a biological point of view, in terms of lost species and native species being reintroduced into the ecosystem and expand the science we use today to restore the species that were lost by bringing in the same species from other areas where they've survived, go back, you know, to the early 1500s when the Spanish first brought the Spanish Iberian horses over. And from a biological point of view, you know, 500 years ago, they reintroduced the horse to North America. And of course, very intensive research shows that after they escaped and multiplied and were taken by First Nations, they were spread across the Americas by First Nations and reached the Northern Rockies and probably the interior BC in the early to mid 1600s. And so by the time the white man came in the early to mid 1600s into the Chilcotin, including Simon Fraser, the First Nations had already had horses for several centuries. And some of that you see in Simon Fraser's journal, where when he went down the river named after him, you know, lo and behold, the First Nations had horses and were obviously had been a horse culture for quite a long time. The other really strong piece of evidence that sort of put the frosting on the cake for me was finding out that between Vernon and Kamloops, near a little place called Westwold, that used to be a stopover for the Fur Brigade, Hudson Bay Fur Brigade horses in the mid to late 1800s, the residents there found remains of horse bones that date back, to 30,000 years ago. And wow. Then near Lumby, they found horse bones that dated back, several 10 or 20,000 years ago or more. I don't remember the exact date. So those relics are in the Canadian Museum and have been studied and carbon dated. So, the old bones have told their story too. And just imagine that, in the last interglacial, that there were horses running free in our BC grasslands that were directly related to the horses of today. So getting back to your asking me about the different genetic makeup of the Chilcotin wild horses, what our study actually found, and this was working with one of the world's equine genetic experts, Dr. Guth Cawthron from Texas A&M University, was there's two subpopulations in the Chilcotin. There's one in the Brittany Triangle, which is a big plateau where we first studied wild horses. And those ones are isolated from most of the other wild horse population. There's probably 200 or 300 in the Brittany Triangle and probably 2,300 to 2,500 in the rest of the Chilcotin. The 2,300 to 2,500 we found are different than Brittany Triangle horses. Those are still Spanish Iberian horses, the horses of conquest. But the ones in the Brittany Triangle had very little Spanish influence. And most of the foundation for those was our Canadian horse, which was brought over to Quebec in the late 1600s and probably spread across the plains by French Canadian fur trappers and traders. And another really unique bloodline called the Yakut East Russian horse, which is only found today in northern Siberia in the Yakut horse north of the Arctic Circle. We did investigate how those Yakut horses would have got into the remote Brittany Triangle. We looked at the Russian fur trade on the BC coast and found that from somebody who had studied the ship logs investigating how curly Mustangs got to North America and published this information, was that the Russians brought very, very few horses to their trading posts on the Pacific coast. And so we just don't know how they got there. That's just something that is left up for future science and study, I guess, but it's just a beautiful thing. Here are these horses we running wild in the Chilcotin that we've been taught to believe are these horrible feral animals, and they're all mixed draft horses and all mixed breeds escaped from the ranchers, are actually horses whose ancestry goes back a long, long ways, and they were brought in from different parts of the world over different time periods by First Nations. So, and there they are. Those genetic bloodlines are incredibly important to protect and preserve.
Is it correct to say that cayuse is the term we would use for all of these horses as in terms of them being wild horses, or is the cayuse a particular genetic blend?
The Chilcotin have used that term for a long time. Cayuse is what they really, they're a sort of word, but it's now being interpreted as cayuse. We think it comes from the Cayuse First Nations who used to live in Idaho and Montana, and they were excellent horse breeders. And we think that's probably where the Spanish horses came from, through the trade trails, through the Okanagan, before the Hudson's Bay started in that area. You think about the Okanagan today, there's the relic Hudson's Bay Fur Trail, up along Okanagan Lake and stuff, but that really wasn't made by the Hudson's Bay. That was ancient indigenous trade trail that had been there long before the Hudson's Bay. So we think that's the pathway that the horses got in the Chilcotin, and they just heard they were called Cuyas or Cayuse, and so they use that word. Interestingly, if you look at the Chilcotin linguistics, they have a real ancient words for the horse, which I can't pronounce. So they have their own words for the horse besides that.
Yeah, you mentioned in your book about how moose hadn't really been in that area in as prolifically as horse, and so the local indigenous word for moose is phonetic. It's just moose, whereas horse they have like a dozen words for. Is that right?
Yeah, they not only a dozen words, but they have, as we have, but they have like dozens of their own terms for different horses, coloration, different ways of riding, all kinds of different things that were already in their linguistics when the first white man came. And of course, the moose is a much later arrival to the Chilcotin. And how it got there was during the last ice age, the moose didn't go extinct. It survived to the north and south of the Kerguelen ice sheet, including in the northern Yukon refugia where the Yukon horse evolved. And it took them 5,000 to 10,000 years of what we call post-glacial distribution to get back to BC. And I remember seeing the first moose where I lived in our valley here in the West Kootenays in the late 1950s.
Wow.
So, yeah, and so having arrived in the Chilcotin in the 1920s, they just, the white men had already been calling them moose where they had arrived elsewhere. So they just adopted MUS as their interpretation.
Amazing. Do you have any sense of how many horses were in this area at first contact with white people? Like, is there any way to estimate? Because what you just described, maybe there's 3,000 or so. There's probably other wild horses, in the stewardship of First Nations, not counted. But let's say there's less than 5,000 wild horses now in BC, probably far less. How many do we think there might have been at first contact in the, early mid 1700s?
It's really hard to say. A few of the indigenous recorded histories, including through the anthropologist, excuse me, James Tait, he kept a lot of notes. So one of the notes he kept was from one of the Okanagan First Nation groups. Talking about thousands of horses running free. And of course, horses to a lot of First Nations were a sign of wealth, not just, just horses, but beautiful horses, horses of different coloration and stuff. So some First Nations kept a lot of horses, and of course, they didn't run. They weren't feeding them hay in the winter. They foraged on their own. And so many of those horses ran free. And if you just needed to replenish your stock, you just went out and snared or, captured a wild one. So it's anybody's guess, but I would say it would, what was in the BC grasslands through the East Kootenays and Okanagan and the Chilcotin and Nicola Valley and stuff, I'm guessing it would probably number in 10,000 or more. But after the bounty hunt from the 1920s to the 1950s, I think it was 4,500 to 5,000 or so. So that would suggest, there were a lot of horses running around out there for a long time.
Yeah, I want to get into that. So tell us about this. Like you just mentioned, the tremendous numbers, thousands of horses were culled. or, you know, rounded up and taken to the slaughter, or they were hunted by the British Columbia government and by people that they hired to do so, that by hunters they hired, and even some Indigenous hunters. So tell us some of this, you know, unknown history. It's so horrifying. And I'm sure that most people don't know how we went from thousands of wild horses across BC and into the prairies to thousands of them being culled.
Yeah, well, what happened was, if you just use the Okanagan for a reference point, the caribou, first there was the Fraser River Gold Rush, and then there was the big caribou gold rush in the early 1860s, and that brought this huge influx of different, you know, gold seekers and businesses and explorers to likely BC, to the where the gold rush was, you know, boats coming up the coast from California. So all of a sudden there was this huge influx of white people trying to get rich, and of course, what are they going to eat? There weren't enough moose or, you know, beaver or whatever to for them to live on. So at that time in our history, south of the Canadian-U.S. border, there were already fairly large established ranches in Idaho and Washington, where they had, I think, brought a lot of Spanish horses up, traded with the Mexicans. So there was a pretty good supply south of the border. And once the drovers who you know, needed, the ranchers needed a market. So once they heard of the gold rush, they started bringing them up to the customs place in Osoyoos, and the records there show there were thousands of cattle driven up through the Okanagan before that area was settled to the caribou gold rush. And of course, you're a rancher cowboy, and what do you see when you get up there? It's all of this, you know, beautiful bunch grass ranch land, as some describe, knee high on your horse, you know. So why bother going back to the States? And of course, a colonial government was being formed to try, I think, with the intent to control the influx of Americans. And so very shortly, you know, they started passed an act for preemption of land. Of course, First Nations weren't allowed to apply. And so there was a bit of a free-for-all for all of these new immigrants, and big ranches started. And then once they got their cattle grazing, there were a lot of cattle grazed out there. There's a lot of evidence that it really wasn't the wild horses that historically overgrazed. It was all the cattle that was turned loose, no fences, free-ranging, expanding ranches and stuff. And so that was just, you know, that happened fairly rapidly. And of course, along the way, there were different laws passed to protect the ranchers' interests. One of them was, you know, to allow grazing on what were still Indigenous lands, but to the exclusion. So once this monopoly, I call it, the cattle industry monopoly of our grassland started, all the laws were passed that favored the cattle ranchers, and at the time the First Nations were being moved against their will onto small reserves and with their livestock, and they were gradually not allowed to leave their horses and even cattle when they still some started ranching out on these lands, which were now quotes on quotes off crown land. And so the ranching community, ranchers at the time, you know, bringing in this pioneering spirit from mostly from the States, anything that got interrupted with their cow operations, grizzly bears, wolves, you know, black bears, wild horses that they felt jeopardized their cattle operations, had to go. So there started this this slaughter and bounty hunt that went on for a long time. And as John Thistle, the researcher who his thesis called it Range Wars and documented so admirably and wrote a book about it, it was like a century of range wars. And all these animals were regarded as pests, including the horse. And so there were thousands and thousands shot off. They were either rounded up and sent for pet food. Many in the Chilcotin, and thousands were just shot on the range. All you had to do was take in the scalp and the ears to collect the bounty. And if you had shot a stallion, you had to take in the testicles along with that. And that continued for a long time. The last bounty hunts were as late as sponsored by the Forest Service as 1988.
Amazing. And so often the reason they cite for this is the degradation of grassland. And that was like a lot of what your work was going in and seeing where's the evidence of this? So where is the evidence that it's the horses? And it seems almost absurd that they needed a biologist when, didn't you say at one point, for every 100 wild horses, it was like 10,000 heads of cattle or something like that? Like, it was just, what was the proportion of cattle to wild horses, let's say in the 70s when, or the 80s at that most recent call?
I can't remember, but when you look at some of the studies that have been done, there have been very few actual range studies that looked at the diet of the horse and the cattle in the same areas, and which animal was causing the range or most range damage. And the one done in the West Chilcotin by a graduate student called Susan Preston in the early 1900s, where there were a lot more cows than wild horses. She concluded that it was the horses mostly causing the diet, even the damage, most of the damage, even though they had similar diets. So, as I say, there's no hard evidence that it was the horses that caused most of the range damage. Our ranges in BC, you look in the Okanagan, they've been horribly overgrazed. They've been taken over by cheatgrass species. There's grassland species at risk. And so the horse was an easy animal to scapegoat and blame while covering up the fact that there were too many cattle. And in some places today, there probably are too many cattle. And it's not to say that the horses are grazing angels, they can overgraze, but there hasn't been so far been any hard evidence to prove that they were the ones responsible. In fact, my when I went to UBC, I took a range management course and went on field trips with and my professor was a renowned range ecologist, Dr. Vern Brink. He was a great man, and I ran across a document by him that, he said, if you should have seen the range in the 1920s, he said it was just like black soil from cattle overgrazing. And I remember running into Dr. Brink before he passed on at an airport and told him what I was studying, wild horses. And we chatted for a while, and he actually supported that they should be protected in preserves and stuff. So that really told me something, that I was on the right track.
I think a lot of people find it astonishing that really humans have been historically, if you look at just the scale of mass death, humans are the number one predator of the wild horse. But it's still pretty surprising that wild horses can survive out in these places with grizzlies and wolves and I think a lot about cougars and stuff as well. So, domestic horses are you if you have them rurally, that's like you're already thinking about how do I protect these things? Maybe it's easier when they're running wild, but what can you tell us about the predator-prey relationship and how it stayed in balance, outside of this human interference for all this time.
Well, you have to remember that during the horse's evolution in North America, it lived in many different ages of the planet with different predators. In the northern Yukon, it lived with wolves, the same wolf as today. It lived with the cave bear. It lived with the grizzly bear. It lived with the saber-toothed lion, which went extinct. So they evolved in the Great Plains, the fescue grasslands, and the northern Yukon and the Ice Age refugia with predators. You know, they were part of the predator-prey ecosystem. And it's basically, even in domestic horses today, you know, I know from our domestic horses at the time, you know, their predator alert system is in their DNA. Just because they've been domesticated, they are very predator aware and seem to know, you know, if there's a mountain lion around and stuff, from my experience anyhow. And so the wild horses in the Chilcotin and Alberta foothills are the only ones left in North America, because there's still way more wild horses in the US and Canada. They're the only last two large populations left in North America that still survive with all of the top predators, the wolf, the grizzly bear, and the mountain lion. The grizzly bears and black bears don't seem to bother them too much, but a study out in the Chilcotin done by biologist Sadie Parr showed that wild horses were the main component of the diet of wolves. And studies elsewhere have shown that mountain lions can even control the population by preying on foals. And, you know, they're wild animals. They live in predator-prey systems for tens of thousands of years. That's how they survived. And as the Chilcotin told us, in the winter when, you know, the normal herd is a family herd with a stallion and a lead mare and some younger horses, and their foals from the spring, you know, they normally stay in their just smaller family herds of 12 to 15 animals. But in the winter, you'll see these huge aggregations of 80 to 100 horses. And the Chilcotins told us that, you know, that was to give them greater protection in the winter when times were tough from wolves and mountain lions.
So how can we ensure that the wild horse does not go extinct in BC? What can we do to help?
Well, I think, first of all, the Chilcotin have taken a big step. You know, the only reason there's horses left in the Chilcotin is because the Chilcotin people have, taken a protective role and kept in the Hunnicutin Chilcotin out in the Maya Valley, kept out the cattle ranchers. They refused to be put on reserves. They drove out the first cattle ranchers. That's all in their stories I put in my book. And because the horse is so ingrained in their Chilcotin heritage cultural values and being out there so long that, you know, they did what they could to protect the horses. And after I finished my research and recommended the Brittany Triangle be Canada's first wild horse refuge, they immediately created a much larger area called the Eagle Lake Henry Cayuse Wild Horse Preserve, which still isn't recognized by the provincial and federal government, but I believe it actually will. And it's now partly protected in Supreme Court ruling Aboriginal title lands. It now covers much of the Brittany Triangle. So they sort of have led the way in Canada. The other place where they are protected is way out on Sable Island off the coast of Nova Scotia, where, you know, it's not really a place they used to exist. It's not really their old native habitat, but the horses were introduced there some centuries ago, and Parks Canada decided to recognize them as a naturalized wildlife species, and so those horses are protected under the Park Act as part of the animals that live on that outer island. So we need to, and that's why I wrote my book, because I needed to publish. So many people I met, wild horses, you know, where are these wild horses? I didn't know we had any left. I go, yeah, we have, you know, 2,800 out in the Chilcotin and 150 in the Highland Valley and some small herds west of Kamloops and 1,600 in the Alberta foothills. I said, but they may not be here 10 or 20 years ago if the cattle ranchers and the range managers keep pecking away at them and doing calls and blaming them for the overgrazing. So my book, I hope, was written partly to raise the awareness of the Canadian and the international public that we need strong provincial and federal legislation to protect these horses. So they're not just people just go out and nobody's around to shoot them, and so they're no longer subject to calls and roundups for slaughter and stuff where the wild ones still exist. Right now, I'm just finishing off a study for some groups who are opposed to the Alberta government wanting to have another wild horse call. And again, there's no hard evidence that it's the Alberta horses that have been causing the range damage and need to be controlled. They are probably controlled by the wolves and mountain lions and starvation winters, just like they probably are out in the Chilcotin. So I want people, Canadians, to wake up and speak up, I think my book is hopefully arming people with all of the right information that's been so well researched that, here's a species that hadn't had much attention, and, you know, stand up for them and make sure they're around 100 years from now for, as part of these intact ecosystems and for a valuable cultural heritage icon of all of our cultures and societies, you know, our own settler culture relationship to the horse is long and deep too when I think about my Irish ancestry and so on. So
absolutely, when I think about my great-great-grandfather, he raised and trained Highland ponies in the Highlands of Scotland. So, you know, yeah, even as settlers, we should care. It was shocking to me to read how the wild horses have been scapegoated by the cattlemen's associations and things. And definitely your book really opened my eyes to the need to protect the wild horse, not only from commercial interests, but from the government itself that is so influenced by commercial interests. And so we have to, I think, definitely protect not only the horse, but also their habitat. And so supporting the Indigenous nations in their Aboriginal rights and title claims is really important to me. And I really appreciated how much you highlighted their good work throughout your book. I also want to ask you, Wayne, about your personal relationship with the horse. You seem to have an almost spiritual relationship with them. You've had, you know, dream time experiences. You've had, research opportunities that have put you in contact with these beings in a way that's so magical and so rare for most humans to see these horses in their habitat. Tell us, why is the horse important to you?
I've been a biologist for a long time. I've always been interested in animals. My main career is a bear biologist. So when I grew up in a mining family in New Denver, and I came from a huge family of nine children. I had a wonderful, loving mother, but my Irish miner prospector father had a bad temper, and I had a pretty physically abused childhood. And so my way of surviving was to go out in nature. I would put on my old wooden skis and go skiing in a snowstorm with the family dogs and watch the deer come into town. And animals were sort of my salvation at a vulnerable early time in my life when you felt like, you know, you were just being, even though my mother was loving, just my father's violence had a really profound effect on me at the time, I think, as child abuse does. And so that gave me this connection that I couldn't find with people. Where are you going to go to look for help in the 1950s if your father beat you up periodically? Like it was quite considered normal, you know? So I developed this affinity for animals and nature, and eventually through a convoluted pathway, that's what led me to study zoology at University of British Columbia, always with the intent that I wanted to be out in the wilderness studying animals. I didn't want to spend my life behind the desk, you know, pushing a pencil. I still spend half my time doing that. So when I arrived in the Chilcotin, I already had a close affinity to bears, were from working on with spirit bears and grizzly bears, helping save the Great Bear Rainforest on the coast for 20, 25 years, including with different conservation groups, the Kootsmithing Grizzly Sanctuary, huge amounts for the spirit bear. And during that work, I had the opportunity, which I hadn't had before, in starting the first bear viewing programs with conservation people we brought in to help make them aware of bears. And I developed this sort of close relationship with bears I hadn't had before, because, you know, when you get close contact to bears, and we got to know the bears, and bears got to know us. So eventually they would get to know what we were feeling, but I would get to know what they were feeling. And if we were viewing and photographing a bear for half an hour, and all of a sudden he gave you a dirty look and didn't want you to be around anymore, you know, you recognize that. So that sort of became my, with that framework, is when I went to the Chilcotin and finally broke down my precepts through having a dream of the stone horse and the beautiful experience of being charged by them. I just started, whenever we saw horses, we just sat and looked at them. And of course, we never got they're hard to get close to, but just began to appreciate their wild spirits and their beauty. And any different in winter and summer, and the wonder of seeing a newborn foals running between their protective mother and father, you know, frolicking and stuff. And yeah, so I think everybody has that capacity within themselves. And I think for many people who now are so hooked on digital stimulation, smartphones, including, you know, so many children now living on their smartphones and computer games and stuff, you know, that's all nice and entertaining, but it's not something that feeds our human spirit and our longing for to deeper relationship with the planet and nature and the animals and everything out there that we're so much a part of. And whatever is behind that and out there that's greater than us, you know, the unknown thing.
Yeah, the numinous.
But I don't consider myself a spiritual person every time I go out and having this deep relationship. I mean, the window might open periodically, and I'm mostly out there with my notebooks and science, just, you know, enjoying exercise and and seeing the else. But it's a whole world out there, and I just hope my book helps people open a doorway for people to be able to go out and see the wild horses and even your domestic horses with new eyes, you know.
For sure.
Sit with them and look into their eyes.
Yeah.
You'll see the whole history and the whole universe in those animals.
Absolutely. So Wayne, how do you cope with the grief and maybe the anger or even the rage that you might feel about the plight of wild horses and, of course, like bears and the ecosystems that you've spent your life working to study so that we can protect them, when it starts to feel futile or when, you know, it feels like there's a relentless onslaught of extractive resource industries that want to come and like they have so much money and so much power. How do you cope with the grief and the rage?
I think because I'm Irish, mostly Irish, I think I found I had a warrior spirit as I moved along. As a young biologist, I found it very depressing when you would go out there and, you know, I worked on pipeline studies. I did work on one of the first environmental impact studies of the Athabasca tar sands. I worked on a wildlife study of the proposed Moran Dam on the Fraser River, and it would just get really depressing. But I realized that, you know, one of the reports we did helped stop the Moran Dam. I was working with an older biologist that would have dammed the whole Fraser River, and I realized that I had the knowledge and tools to use science to help arm people who were trying to save areas. But it was very depressing. I think I bottomed out when I went to the Kootsmatin Valley to do some research. I organized the first expedition because it was going to be logged, and I saw 1,000-year-old spruce trees, and it was just like the Grizzly Valley of all Grizzly Valleys. And the logging company was, the timber rights were granted. They were building a sawmill to cut the big giant spruce trees in Prince Rupert. And I just felt it was an unsurmountable task to try and save that area with the control that the timber industry had and still has over our natural resources, unfortunately. And I remember going into a deep depression and waking up one night and saying, why am I here? Why am I doing this to myself? And going up and saying, I don't have to feel this anymore. I don't have to feel overwhelmed. I don't have to feel small. I need to go out and I need to speak up. I need to organize, work with conservation groups, which I was at the time, and stop getting, it's easy to you know, feel like it is overwhelming at times, so there's no need to stay there. Mm-hmm. And so working with conservation groups and other scientists, we saved the Kootsmatin Valley. We went on to save a lot of areas in the Great Bear Rainforest, the Valhalla Wilderness Society I work with here in the Kootenays, who are a great bunch of people. We've saved, you know, many different provincial parks. And I think what I find hard to cope with is today is the fact that of climate change and what it's doing to the planet. As a biologist, I think you're more tuned in to, you know, the temperature change and the wildfires and the fact that the changes aren't happening at a gradual linear scale. They're happening and exponentially, which means, you know, the wildfire smoke feeds into more carbon, and the more planes we fly to try and bomb wildfires, the more carbon we're putting in. And what I find discouraging, because my wife and I own 2 electric vehicles and we don't fly, I'd love to go to Italy, but we don't take pleasure holidays anymore to reduce our carbon footprint. I just find it discouraging out there that a lot of people who are fairly well off and retired, you know, are still not seeing what we're all contributing to and how much more we can each be doing on an individual or local or societal level. And I just hope people will start waking up more and start, you know, we do have to give up things to help save the planet. The party's over. And I find that hard to cope with. You know, I stopped reading about, I stopped listening, I turn the news off sometimes. I already know what's going on, but I do try to educate people and gently try and encourage people to, you know, do their part or speak up more for protecting old growth. And, you know, there are lots of things we can do to help reduce climate change. We just all have to, as my late Inoxala, elder friend Cecil Paul, who helped save the Kitlope, we all just hop in the magic canoe and dig in our paddles and start paddling to help reduce the carbon footprint. And there are lots of people doing it, lots of good things out there, lots of positive news, and but we need to be doing more.
Well, this book that you've written is a wonderful legacy piece that we can all stand behind now and feel armed, feel educated, and thank you for all your work in preserving and helping to save all of these parks and ecosystems in BC. That is an incredible, incredible legacy and gift to the future. Wayne, you're a national treasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Carmen. I really appreciate it.
Okay, two things. First of all, I always have to chuckle when someone says the most beautiful, tender, touching, spiritual thing you've ever heard about their inner life, and then they qualify it by saying, but I don't consider myself a spiritual person. I hear that so often, and I always have to just laugh at that. I think it, yeah, it's just very sweet to me how bashful people can be about matters of the spirit and of the heart and of the deeper substance that connects all life. I'm so honored that we got to hear more about Wayne, the person behind the great works. Okay, second thing though, am I the only person who can't get over the fact that moose have only been in the Chilcotin since the 1920s? What? Like, I've spent a pretty good deal of time listening to Indigenous elders, ranchers, guide outfitters, hunters from that area. Not a one has ever mentioned, oh yeah, by the way, like the moose hunt is a relatively new thing. Or like, oh yeah, they weren't always here. Like, I'm gobsmacked. And I feel kind of silly for some reason that like this small fact out of Wayne's whole book is like a thing that's kind of sticking with me. I guess it just reminds me that ecosystems are not static, and in some ways they change rather quickly, and then the baseline perception shifts just as quickly. Like, there's a cultural forgetting that these animals have not always been here, and it's a privilege to have them here with us. This actually reminds me of our dear friend J.B. McKinnon's book, The Once and Future World, where he talks about the shifting baselines of how much smaller megafauna and like fish in the sea have gotten over the past century, and photographic evidence of how there's this like great story that James has in that book about, and it has the pictures of this family where there'd been like five generations of family that would go, like, I don't know if it was marlin or halibut fishing. They did some kind of fishing. It must have been marlin because they were down in Florida. And there's all these black and white photos of people, you know, they come in from their vacation fishing with these massive fish, like as big as a man. And then they show them through the generations with this like annual holiday, moving through the, you know, colored film, the 70s, the 80s to today. And the fish keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until it's just like this, you know, 4 foot long thing, 3 foot long thing. But the people are just as happy in every single photo. Like the people don't have a sense of the shifting baseline of how we expect so much less. We're just accustomed to things being depleted and things being more rare. Anyway, I shudder to think that my child or the generation after that would not know that there were wild horses in BC. And I wish it was clear what more can be done to protect the wild horses of BC. At the time of this broadcast, there are no like active campaigns that I can find. And I've looked with like repeated and creative Google searching. However, at the back of Wayne's book, there are several Indigenous and grassroots organizations working directly with the horses, and you can support them financially with donations, and some of them are active on social media. I'll link to a couple of those in the show notes, and you'll find the show notes in your podcast player or at numinouspodcast.com. So please, buy the book, share the book, talk about the book, gift it to friends. It'll be good for people who like books about history, who like ecology, if they're interested in like the Gold Rush era and the wild frontier. Like, why not learn about conservation and the truth of this fascinating topic? So Wild Horses of the Chilcotin, Their History and Future is available everywhere now. Okay. My listener shout out today, back to listener shout outs, been on hiatus for a little bit here, but back to my listener shout outs. Today it's to Arlen, who left a few messages in the podcast inbox. I'm going to focus on the main one. Arlen wrote, I haven't been listening long, but I wondered if you were aware of Vanessa Machado Oliveira's book, Hospicing Modernity, or Dougald Hines' At Work in the Ruins. Both of those have been giving me a glimpse of how we might navigate collapse in generative ways. Thank you, Arlen. So I don't know exactly which of my collapse episodes you're listening to, but thank you for listening. Yes, I'm very aware of Machado Oliveira's work. Love it. Also aware of Hine, but since you're pretty new around these parts, I just want to give you the heads up, and this is for like anyone who's newer to me, my work, the podcast. So part of my work in the world is my divestment from the white male imagination. And I know that's kind of interesting of me to say, considering my recent guest, but stick with me. I would say I spend less than like easily less than 5% of my time consuming the work of white men. For the most part, I don't read them, I don't watch them, I don't listen to them, I definitely don't give them my money, I don't vote for them. And specifically with regard to collapse, having been deep in collapse studies for over a decade, which is an area that is, again, like so many, overwhelmingly dominated by white men, I've just had my fill. You know, I'm not saying there aren't plenty of nice and interesting white men doing good enough work. I just know that there are many more, mostly unheard of women doing great work. And that's just where I want to give my attention. So like, for example, big shout out to Sharon Astick, a demigoddess amongst us. We are so lucky collectively to have her. Anyway, after a decade of deep study, I know many other women too, but like now, really, the only expert on collapse I listen to anymore is Sharon Astick, and I would highly recommend you find her on Facebook, read her books. I will link to her in the show notes. And yeah, I'll just say that, like, especially now, since I interviewed Clark Strand in 2023 and now Wayne in 2024, it's only March, I've like already pretty much hit my quota. But thanks for thinking of me. And also thank you, Arlen, for the suggestions. There were other notes. You mentioned Göbekli Tepe. I couldn't understand in the context of which episode, but yes, I'm aware of it. And I took a really excellent course with Yvonne Owens on the lost civilizations of old Europe. I think that was like 2017 or 18. Yvonne Owens is a world-renowned feminist scholar who happens to live in my city. I'm so lucky. So I don't really know what you were writing that in response to. The comment was kind of out of text to me, but thank you for your interest. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your messages. I appreciate your shares. I love the way you think. I like the kind of thought train you're riding on. The Numinous Podcast is a proud supporter of the People's Public Health Education Campaign. Wearing is caring, my friends. Did you know that surgical masks are not primarily designed to protect healthcare workers from airborne particles? You know what I mean? Those inexpensive, kind of like accordion folded surgical masks that are like kind of just out there free in a lot of, offices and environments. They're actually used to reduce bacterial spread from the nose, mouth, and face. However, of course, they're cheap and they have been shown to be better than a cloth mask or nothing. So we know, though, that SARS-CoV-2, aka COVID, is airborne. And it's a virus, not a bacteria. So do yourself a favor and invest in some N95 masks. They are designed to block 95% of airborne particles. And America's National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health say that that level of filtration effectively catches the airborne particles that can spread COVID-19. Hey, do you want to hang out with people who like really care about the kinds of things I'm talking about here on the show? Because a bunch of us are hanging out in the Numinous Network. It's a sanctuary that cares for the caregivers and nurtures the nurturers. And you can find out more about the Numinous Network. And while you're there, like sign up for my newsletter at carmenspagnola.com. CarmenSpagnola. Until next time, take care.